It's a complete waste.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
China approves amendments that would see changes to the method for the formation of Hong Kong's Legislative Council and its voting procedures. More than 8,000 British pupils joined a campaign to report sexual abuse in public and private schools across the UK. Also in the headlines, Iran's foreign minister says intra-Afghan talks are the only possible way to bring peace and stability to Afghanistan. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The Chinese parliament has approved sweeping reforms to Hong Kong's electoral system. The reforms have been signed into law by President Xi Jinping. They reduce the number of directly elected seats in Hong Kong's local parliament to 20 from the current 35. That provides room for some 30 seats to be occupied by representatives of various industries. The reforms also require Hong Kong's candidates for office to be approved by a joint vetting committee from both the city and China. The changes were announced earlier this month. Beijing says that they are necessary to ensure that only patriots govern Hong Kong. The city has witnessed anti-government protests in the past months. Analyst and commentator Fabrizio Goldoni says rioters backed by external forces made China's moves on Hong Kong necessary.
This electoral reform was needed after the introduction of the national security law. We have riots before. With these people have political motivation and were colluded with external forces. So now is important that the trouble that we have outside doesn't go inside in the legislature. So this kind of reform is exactly this national security law. So we must be sure that the patriots are the people that love China and the people that are not conflicting with the national security law. It means secession, subversion of state power, collusion with external forces or even terrorism, because in the past we have this experience. It's important that the National Security Unit check the background of some of the people. I'll make you an example. Some people, for example, they fly to the United States to ask United States to put sanctions on Hong Kong. Imagine which kind of people we are talking about. It's quite serious, these kind of crimes. These people, they want to do politics.
The British website has recorded thousands of testimonies of sexual abuse from pupils in public and private schools across the country. The website, called Everyone's Invited, was set up last year. Its founder says the allegations show that rape culture is a problem in all UK schools. Education Secretary Gavin Williamson has called the testimonies shocking and abhorrent. He has pledged to take appropriate action. Parliament members have also called for a full inquiry into the cases. More than 8,000 testimonies of sexual harassment have been anonymously recorded on Everyone's Invited website. The majority of the accounts have described acts of sexual abuse and violence by young men against young women at school, college, or university. The UK is struggling with more anger and outrage as the country's Conservative government ignores calls to scrap its new policing bill. The draft legislation is yet to become law, but the way that British police have dealt with protests over the past couple of weeks has given everyone a taste of how peaceful protests are going to be treated once law enforcement are awarded their new powers. Said Burza has more from London.
Another weekend of protests in the UK. This was Saturday in the southwestern city of Bristol, the front line of the battle against the British government's new policing bill that places new limits on protests. Demonstrators, for instance, could face new fines of up to 10 years in prison for damaging a statue or memorial. The peaceful demonstration descended into violence at some point. Police were pelted, protesters pepper sprayed, and charged at with dogs. 10 were arrested. The man who filmed this footage in Bristol is a journalist for the Daily Mirror. This is what happened next. A day later, more protests. Thousands took to the streets across Britain. In Manchester, they blocked the tram lines. They were forcefully removed. 18 of them arrested. The UK police cracked down on protests since the murder of a young woman, allegedly at the hands of a police officer, has been under scrutiny. Critics have accused them of using deliberate and orchestrated tactics against the protesters. Last week, police retracted their claims that some officers suffered serious injuries during attempts to disperse a similar protest last weekend. But the government has remained uncompromising. Since the violent clashes in Bristol, it's condemned the protesters. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called the clashes disgraceful, and his Home Secretary Priti Patel described the protesters as thugs intent on causing trouble.
The contentious bill is still being debated in the UK Parliament. Critics say it gives draconian powers to the police, curtails freedoms, and does too little to protect women and girls. So far, the government has shown no sign of changing course, and those protesting against the bill say neither are they. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says that stability can be achieved in Afghanistan only through intra-Afghan talks. Zarif was addressing a regional conference on Afghanistan held in Tajikistan. He urged regional governments and the UN to focus on facilitating talks between different Afghan groups. Top Iranian diplomats said that his country will keep up efforts to pave the way for peace in the country. Zarif rejected as unconstructive the solutions imposed by outside players in Afghanistan. He stressed that any peace agreement there must guarantee the Afghan people's right to self-determination. Afghanistan has been in a turmoil since the U.S. invasion in 2001. Tehran reiterates that the only path to reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is for the U.S. to lift all sanctions on the country. This after a new report in the U.S. media said that Washington plans to make a new proposal to Iran.
A senior Iranian official said that Tehran will stop its 20% uranium enrichment only if the U.S. lifts all its sanctions on the Islamic Republic first. The official said Tehran will further reduce its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal if the U.S. does not end all sanctions, warning that Washington is rapidly running out of time. The remarks are in response to a report published in Politico that said Washington is to offer a new proposal to Tehran to jumpstart the talks on the nuclear deal as soon as this week. This comes as the Iranian president has already rejected the notion of talks on the nuclear deal. Hassan Rouhani said, since Washington did not sit for talks when it left the deal, its return to the agreement also merits no negotiations, but a mere political will.
The proposal asks Iran to halt some of its nuclear activities, such as work on advanced centrifuges and the enrichment of uranium to 20% purity in exchange for some relief from U.S. economic sanctions.
After a year of full compliance with the agreement following U.S. withdrawal, Iran gradually started to scale down its nuclear deal commitments because the European parties to the accord, under pressure from the U.S., failed to meet their obligations. Iran says its countermeasures conform to the terms of the deal that allows one side to reduce commitments when others do not honor theirs. Since taking office, U.S. President Joe Biden has followed his predecessor Donald Trump's policies vis-a-vis the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Experts believe U.S. policies toward Iran have always been hostile, irrespective of who is in charge of the White House.
The U.S. is determined to overthrow the Iranian government, but it cannot overthrow the Iranian government. And so here we have a situation where the U.S. policy can't really succeed, and the U.S. politicians won't back away from a consensus position that exists within the American establishment.
The Biden team has repeatedly said Washington is open to talks with Tehran, stressing that the ball is in Iran's court to revive the accord. Washington says Iran must first return to full compliance and the U.S. would then rejoin the accord. Iran has, however, rejected the U.S. position, stressing that Washington must take the first step and lift all sanctions because it was the U.S. that left the agreement in the first place. The Iranian president maintained that the remarks by Iran's leader make it very clear that Tehran would fulfill all its commitments if and only if the U.S. returns to its obligations under the deal.
Convoy belonging to the U.S.-led military coalition has been targeted in southern Iraq. Security sources have told local media that the convoy carrying logistical equipment was targeted by a roadside bomb. The incident happened in Dikar province. There has been no immediate word on possible damage or casualties. U.S.-led forces under supply convoys in Iraq have repeatedly come under attack in the past months. The attacks have happened as sentiments run high against the presence of foreign forces, especially American troops. Those sentiments began to rise after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani last January. After the killing, the Iraqi parliament voted for the withdrawal of U.S. forces. Yemenis have entered the seventh year of war and blockade, and the sufferings still continue. This has prompted authorities in Sana'a to organize a photo gallery that puts on display examples of the dire humanitarian crisis in the Arab country. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdellatif Al-Washali, has more.
A photo gallery was organized at the Yemeni capital Sana'a to view examples of the difficulties facing Yemenis amid the continued siege imposed by the Saudi-led coalition.
From the first moment, the Saudi-led coalition has directly targeted civilians, including those internationally protected, which under international law should not be considered military targets. Mosques, monuments, museums, hospitals, schools, universities, roads, bridges, ports, airports, everything in the country has been systematically targeted by Saudi Arabia.
The health sector is heavily affected by the ongoing Saudi siege. Recently, many health facilities have warned that the incubators may stop working completely within days due to the severe fuel shortage and lack of power, putting the lives of infants at risk.
The stoppage of fuel will absolutely stop all aspects of life. The crisis is deteriorating day after day. These children need constant care, and fuel must be provided continuously in order to provide the heat as well as oxygen that incubators need to preserve the lives of children.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, mostly women and children, and imposed an all-out blockade on the country, depriving millions of Yemenis of their basic needs.
Yemenis say the United Nations bears responsibility for the lives of millions of civilians, including infants, as it remains silent toward the Saudi war crimes against their country. Abdellatif Al-Washali, Al-Sabain Hospital in Sana'a.
The monitoring group in Myanmar says more than 500 people have so far been killed in the junta crackdown on anti-coup protests there. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners says the real toll could be significantly higher. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has said it is absolutely unacceptable to see violence against people at such high levels. He has called for a united global front to put pressure on Myanmar's junta. The US, Britain, and the EU have already imposed sanctions in response to the coup and crackdown. The military, however, has refused to ease it off. It staged a coup on February the 1st on election fraud and detained civilian leaders. Protests have continued unabated since then, calling for civilian rule. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the murder of George Floyd and the trial of the white police officer responsible for his death. Let's take a listen. Chloe Campbell is our correspondent from Washington, D.C., who joins us to give us the latest on that. And we also have Omali Yeshitela, who's the founder of Uhuru Movement, who joins us from St. Petersburg, Florida. Colin, at this point, we've heard the opening statement that is ongoing by the lawyer. I forget his name, Jerry. I forget his last name.
Benjamin Crump. Benjamin Crump.
And Crump, exactly. What type of coverage will we see? Is it going to be widespread? We heard the judge talk about the daily coverage that's going to happen. Is that how the media outlets across the states will cover this?
Yeah, most definitely, as we know that this is going to be a much-anticipated trial in the prosecution of Derek Chauvin, and to see if there will really be any justice. Of course, ultimate justice won't be served because George Floyd will still be dead, but will there be as close as there can be to justice with the prosecution and the incarceration of a former police officer who is accused of killing an unarmed black man. So many times we've seen this happen over and over again, ending in an acquittal where some police are able to return to their jobs, where they get really a slap on the wrist for taking the life of an individual who is unarmed. Well, with the opening arguments that we heard from prosecuting attorney Jerry Blackwell and from the prosecuting team, we have heard that they are going to bring in a myriad of experts talking about how the knee on the back of George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. I know this is a little bit different timing than we've heard repeated over and over again, but according to the prosecuting attorney, it was almost 9.5 minutes that the knee was on the back of George Floyd, and how that could have led to his death. Most of us already have seen the video, but for some of these jury members, they may not be as familiar as a lot of Americans are. And they'll bring in experts, they'll bring in members of various police, the police force, to talk about policing policies and how Chauvin didn't follow them. They'll bring in medical experts to talk about the stress that was put on Floyd's system. They said that this will, and that how it all came about, the counterfeit $20 bill, and not even really saying that George Floyd knew that the bill was counterfeit, that it could have been just a violation, a misdemeanor, where he could have been given a ticket, and the courts could have totally processed this claim, and that could have been the end of it. But what it led to, obviously, was Floyd's death over a $20 bill that could or could not have been counterfeit. And we'll hear from this, and this will definitely be covered by the media throughout the next several days, if not weeks.
Okay, Amani Yeshitella, obviously the stage is set now. We're looking at this trial. The world is watching. And you have had the family lawyer who talked about this say that this is going to be a trial that is a referendum of the American justice system. Do you think justice is going to prevail?
I think if we recognize that the United States government has a colonial relationship with African people in the United States, then we can say justice will prevail, but it will be the justice of a colonizer, because the colonizer is incapable of actually bringing justice to the colonized. And if we want to look at a referendum for the American justice system, I think the May 25th murder of George Floyd represents a part of the referendum on the justice system. Just as the murder of Mike Brown, just as the murder of so many other Africans who I've spoken to you about over the last few years. It happens regularly, happens all the time, and it is justice from their perspective. There is an entire industry that has grown up where entrepreneurs, in particular lawyers, make a lot of money off of these murders. And even the discussion about this as some kind of referendum of justice is something that suggests that the American justice system, as it's characterized, is usually something that can be seen as okay, but this will be a defining issue, and it's never okay.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Amani Yeshitella, founder of Uhuru Movement from St. Petersburg, Florida. Also like to thank Colin Campbell, our correspondent there, who was talking to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks to both of you. And that brings us to the end of this news review. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing National Birds, directed by German filmmaker Sonja Kennebec. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him, we have Dan Glazebrook, who's a journalist, political analyst, and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, National Bird follows the harrowing journey of three U.S. military veteran whistleblowers determined to break the silence surrounding the U.S.'s secret drone war. Tortured by guilt for their participation in the killing of faceless so-called suspects abroad, and despite the threats of being prosecuted, these three veterans offer an unprecedented look inside this secret program to reveal the haunting cost of the U.S.'s global drone strikes.
Maybe we killed our objective, maybe we killed a guy who we thought was our objective. You don't know.
When I first got into the military and was thinking it was a force for good in the world, I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was.
I still have a top secret clearance, so I have to be extraordinarily cautious about what I can't say on camera.
My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, and identify everything.
Adolescent near the rear of the SUV.
That's deceptive. You get the opinion that you're at 10,000 feet, you see this photograph, you know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. You know what you see in two dimensions.
You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them.
It's too easy. They just embolden commanders.
Thunder's in, but the party begins.
Because there is no threat.
Oh, sweet target.
I mean, this could grow to get so out of control.
Somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door shoved FBI badges in my face.
The Espionage Act is one of the most serious charges you can level against an American.
That I'm probably going to get indicted and I'm probably going to get charged.
I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program. It's a secret program. I can't just go telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, it's frightening.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Sonja Kennebec, the director, she won an award for this documentary with the Nation Institute, and she said in her award acceptance speech that she initially set out to make this documentary solely just about drones and drone warfare, but then it developed into something much more than this. Of course, we learn of the stories of the three characters in the documentary, and she wanted to focus also on the consequences of whistleblowing and espionage and all these sorts of issues. And Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, you can always tell there's something in the air, both literally and figuratively in this case, when filmmakers start making films about the same kind of thing. So in recent years, we've had three or four movies on the subjects of drones. We've had this, we've had the documentary called Drone, which is a slightly more arty and abstract version of this story. But we've also had feature films like Good Kill with Ethan Hawke as a drone pilot, and Eye in the Sky, a British film with Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren. So there's clearly something going on that filmmakers, they want to be a part of this conversation. And I think part of the situation is that we are still all, we're all making our way through this moral maze at the moment. We're all dealing with the ramifications of drone technology. We're trying to figure out what the consequences are, the good points and the bad points. And I think filmmakers like Sonja Kennebec here, they all want to have a say in that conversation.
And of course, as you said, there's been a resurgence in this topic of drone warfare and moral obstacles around it. And we've had, this documentary had Wim Wenders as the executive producer, of course, who's a multi-winning, award-winning German filmmaker. How much impact do you think he had in this documentary?
Well, he's one executive producer, and he, you know, Wim Wenders in the past has had an interest in surveillance technology. He made a very interesting film at the end of the last century called The End of Violence, which is about surveillance technology in America as it was back then, and obviously things have moved on very rapidly from that. The other executive producer is Errol Morris, who is, you know, a revered documentarian, and has made things like The Fog of War in the past. So he himself is also very interested in this subject matter. So it obviously helps a young up-and-coming filmmaker when you can get two great filmmakers, two revered filmmakers with the industry, to put their names on the credit of the film. You know, it all ties in with some of the work they've done in the past.
And Dan, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on National Bird?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but to be honest, I find this quite often with films on this subject, the tendency to focus on the emotional turmoil of the operators and really the perpetrators. I find, to be honest, slightly distasteful, really, given that the primary victims, obviously, of drone warfare are the people getting blown up and getting their legs blown up and so on. And they do feature in the film, and they have quite an extended section in Afghanistan talking to the victims, but you never get the feeling that they get the same full kind of personhood ascribed to them by the filmmaker. You don't see this sort of rich emotional life that's depicted of the operators and the perpetrators, and I feel like that's actually is playing into the hands of the dehumanization that allows things like the drone program to exist. Because yes, Afghans are in the film, but they're really there just as victims who you know kind of walk around and then get bombed. There's no real feel of what it's like for them, what their lives are like. So I find it difficult.
I see your point, Dan, but one could argue that the role of whistleblowers and journalists, of course, shine a light on these issues, otherwise that would be ignored. And I think Sonia probably emphasizes this in the documentary.
Absolutely, and you know that what they've done to come out against the program is commendable. But I think even to kind of do justice, if you like, to the operators depicted in the film themselves, you know, what turned them against what they're doing is that at some point they had a realization, my God, these are human beings that I'm killing. They're just like me or my mom or my neighbor. And I don't think that realization that's led to them being racked by guilt is fully given to us as a viewer. And I think that's problematic.
I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually pushed the button. I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. We can't just bomb someone and fly away. We have to follow through. The bomb hit and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see like the body parts. You can identify like that could be the lower half of his body. And that could be a leg. And then sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or like pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket. And a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry them back to their compound.
So you really feel for her in this documentary. Indeed, the other characters also, but she seems to come across as the one most plagued and crippled by guilt for her role in the drone program. Mike, what do you make of how her character is portrayed?
Well, she's not a million miles away from the Ethan Hawke character in Good Kill, the feature film that came out a couple of years ago, in that, you know, she was very much in the room watching this footage come in. And the sense that I got from her watching this film is that it's very different from being a soldier on the ground. If you're a soldier on the ground, you know pretty much that you've killed someone if you haven't killed someone. The sense that I get from her, the issues that she's working through are connected to the fact that nobody has told her who she's killed, how many people she's killed. This is hanging over her, and you get a sense of this issue bearing down on her. It's like she's got something over her head, and that is a very powerful thing.
And Dan, I know you say the true victims are, of course, the targets of the drone strikes. But in this documentary, you see Heather and the others almost come across as victims in their own right, and perhaps particularly connected to the US military's recruitment campaigns. I mean, it's sold off, as you see, as a glorious sort of career you could have, and that you're on the right side of history and justice. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Oh, certainly. They are victims as well. They're secondary victims, I would say. But certainly, I mean, they're recruited into it pretty much as children. And to talk about the majority of drone operators being 18 to 24. So they're recruited at 18, practically children, but they'll be kind of groomed effectively from 16, 17. If you think about the involvement of the Pentagon with the video games industry, they're really being groomed from the age of whenever they start playing video games, 8, 7, 6, into this, into this role. So it's really, it is a form of institutional child abuse within America, you know, what America is doing to its own children, and here in this country in Britain as well, same thing. Certainly, and of course they're sold, as you say, the idea of being on the right side of history. One of the people involved in the program said,
"I have this real sense of moral righteousness, and that they set out to do the right thing.
Yeah.
They have good intentions at heart."
Exactly, but it's it is child abuse, and you see the impact, and the fact that they're not even allowed to talk to therapists because the therapists don't have security clearance. So the other thing that they would want to discuss is classified, and so on. So absolutely, the treatment of them by the military is shocking. And you hear testimony from Heather in the film that her kind of commanding officers were constantly questioning her judgment. She was saying, "I think there's women and children here," and so on. And they're saying, "Oh, are you sure? I don't think so. Let's fire anyway," and being overruled and so on. Absolutely. They are victims as well. I just don't think they're the primary victims.
That's a good point. And Mike, I just really quickly want to talk about the shots that are used in this documentary. We see a lot of aerial shots. And do you think the director did this intentionally to give the Western viewer the sense of what it's like to be watched? Because a lot of the shots are in US or suburban areas.
Yeah, I mean, the film sort of flips on its head halfway through, and we get a sense that the people who've been employed as watchers are now the watched. And that is very much there in all those drone shots over American cities, American towns. Drones have revolutionized the way movies in general have been made, because now it's much cheaper to do aerial shots rather than hiring big bulky crane equipment. You can just fly a plane or fly a drone above people's heads. So that has changed as well, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so many films on this subject. The technology, the form and the content are married in this respect.
It's a really interesting point, and I think one of the strengths of the documentary is it shows how barbaric and brutal drone strikes are. And Mike, if I could ask you, what did you make of this journey to Afghanistan and this story?
I liked it very much. I mean, we see so many documentaries that set out their case in the first hour and then spend the second hour driving home the same points over and over again. Here, I think you get a sense of a story developing in real time. There's a sense that this technology has been thrust upon us, and like I say, we're all making and negotiating our way through this moral maze. And when it does finally get to Afghanistan, you get a sense there from that clip, the plane comes over, of just how normalized this kind of life has been. I mean, the fact it's called National Bird, would suggest that the drone has now become part of the natural order of things, part of the landscape for so many people, in ways both good and terrifying.
That's a really interesting point. And Dan, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Mike just said? What did you make of the journey to Afghanistan in this documentary?
Well, I was glad they included it, because about 40 minutes into the film, I thought, are we going to hear anything from any Afghans whatsoever? And they did spend an extended period of time in Afghanistan. But as I said, I still didn't feel really they came across fully as agents. They were still depicted as, they were shown as suffering and as victims, but they're portrayed as only victims, just kind of passive recipients, really, of US air power. There was no agency there. No narrative, no Afghan narrative was present, and there was no politics whatsoever in the film. And I think there's a real danger. The Glasgow Media Group had a really interesting study out a few years ago on the Palestine-Israel conflict, and they found that a lot of journalists were quite sympathetic to the Palestinians, but they knew that they weren't really allowed in Western media to actually put forward a Palestinian narrative about resistance to occupation and so on. So instead of that, in place of that, they just parade this endless parade of Palestinian suffering, but overlain with an Israeli narrative to justify it. Mm-hmm. And I think the danger by not giving any kind of Afghan narrative, we just see, we see the Afghan suffering, but there's no narrative, there's no other side of the story. The danger is that you have the same thing with the Palestine-Israel conflict, because people have pity for the Palestinians, but the overall view in the West, whenever Israel attacks, is well, it's a sort of necessary evil in the war against terrorism. It's terribly sad, and we pity them, but it kind of has to be done. And I think there's a danger this film will have the same effect. People feel sorry for the Afghans or pity them, but won't necessarily just see, oh, it's a shame these innocent bystanders die and so on, but that's kind of necessary.
Mike, so would you have liked to see more political context to this documentary?
There's certainly scope for a more comprehensive and possibly slightly drier documentary about drone technology and the politics of deployment. I mean, this is not a film about the systemic application of drone technology. It's not about the technological specifics of it. It is a human story, and those are the documentaries that tend to get sold at international marketplaces, play at festivals these days, because they're very easy to relate to. I still think we're in the early days, of this technology, and there will be a more comprehensive documentary than the ones that we've seen so far. But in terms of a primer of how this affects both the watched and the watchers, I thought it was pretty solid.
Well, thank you for that point.
This is global. This is getting information anywhere at any time, shooting people from anywhere at any time, and it's not just one person sitting there with a little remote control, a little joystick, moving around a plane that's halfway across the world. That's not all there is. It's like borders don't matter anymore. And there's a huge system that spans the globe that can just suck up endless amounts of your life, your personal data. I mean, this could grow to get so out of control. And we're not the only ones that have this. This is going to be commonplace if it's not already. It's a secret program. And what that means is that I can't just go shouting off the hilltops telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, one person who worked within this massive thing, it's frightening.
So Mike, in the documentary we hear from President Obama give a televised speech talking about the drone warfare operation. And he says how it operates in such a way to ensure minimal loss of life and that they're precise and surgical strikes. Of course, in the documentary, we learn that it isn't really that precise. And Daniel even says, one of the characters, that an element of guesswork is involved. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, I mean, everyone does seem to be operating in some kind of grey area. I mean, we've seen from the clips that actually the images that the drones beam back to the operators in America are very fuzzy. I mean, there's a degree of ambiguity in those very images, never mind in the ethics of using this technology. And so what's interesting is what the film says about the way this technology has been sold to us. So it's clearly been sold to young army recruits as an exciting new development of the war on terror, and we see the adverts in the films that are all, they are like an advert for a computer game, as you say. But there's also a degree to which you think someone must have sold President Obama on this, that this is a new, clean way of killing, that you're killing, you're somehow keeping killing at arm's length, but you're still getting dirty hands. And I think this is something that all the people in the film are wrestling with.
Mm. Now, Dan, I think many people would be surprised to find that actually there were 10 times more strikes during President Obama's presidency than under George W. Bush's predecessor. What do you make of Obama's role in the drone warfare?
Well, on the one hand, drone warfare is a kind of terrifying, dystopian kind of future brought into the present. But at the same time, that shouldn't blind us to the fact that it is driven by desperation on the part of the Western powers. They tried big ground operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fallout in terms of blood and treasure was so great that they just are not in a position to do that again. Mm-hmm. Colin Powell said the U.S. Army is just about broken by Iraq. So they don't have that option. So when you say, was Obama, who sold Obama on this idea? Well, the reality was he didn't, if he wanted to continue making war, and there's a whole systemic pressure to do so within the U.S. government apparatus, then, the former options have been ruled out. Mm. It's no longer feasible to have these mass ground scale operations.
Like in the Vietnam War, over 50,000 U.S. personnel died.
Right.
And this was one of the factors that led to pressure the government to pull out.
Yeah.
But do you think if they had drones at the time, that they would just have an endless war?
Well, this is an interesting question, isn't it? And quite feasibly, yeah, because it was the body bag coming home from Vietnam that drove the pressure to end the war. You're right. With mm-hmm. drones, there's no U.S. body bags. There's only Afghan body bags. Mm-hmm. And then there's obviously mental health fallout. Well, it's interesting. The U.S. casualties do exist. Heather talked about three of her friends on the drone program committing suicide. Mm-hmm. But of course, that doesn't have this generate the same headlines as a coffin coming home draped in a flag.
And a final say to you, Mike, would you recommend this documentary?
I think it's certainly worth watching. I think, you know, this is one of those technologies that has proliferated very quickly. And like I say, we're all still wrestling with the ramifications of it, the consequences of it. It's not a bad place to start. I still think there'll be a more comprehensive documentary some years down the line.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your insights. And that's all the time we have for this episode of Duck Review. And thank you again to both my guests and to you. And feel free to make suggestions about documentaries that you would like us to review. I've been Camilla Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Duck Review.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
This type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
for Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd al-Salam.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته and welcome to IRIB English Radio and another program of For Humanity where we are discussing the رسالة الحقوق the treaties of rights of Imam السجاد زين العابدين peace be upon him we've come across a variety of subjects and we have discussed many things that are related to how we are able to correctly socially interact with other people who are around us. And one of the things that we do regularly perform, maybe consciously, maybe subconsciously, is give advice and request advice from other people. Of course, Imam al-Sajjad, peace be upon him, is saying that there are certain obligations and rights that we have that need to be taken in the reciprocal form on both sides of you being the person who is requesting advice or you being the person that is asking for advice. Here in the section that we are up to in Risalatul Huquq, where we are talking about Haqqul Mustansih, which means the rights of one who seeks your counsel. We know that nasiha, giving nasiha, accepting nasiha is a fundamental practice in Islam. It's something that Islam encourages very, very much. And so when a person gets to that level of wanting to interact with other people in their lives on the social level, then at the same time they need to make sure that they meet the requirements of those who are around them. We need to take care of those who are around us. We need to make sure that we uplift the social, moral, spiritual, religious status of those who are around us. And that's why it's very, very important for us to take care of those who are some way or another a part of the fabric of society. And this is exactly why the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, in many cases, speaking about the neighbors, speaking about the haqq of the neighbor, the rights of your neighbors and things like that, saying that if you sleep and your neighbor is hungry, then you are not among the believers. This is purely for the sake of us realizing that there is an obligation that we need to tend to in making sure that we look at those around us at the same way as we look into a reflecting mirror. Al-mu'minu mir'atu akhihi. Al-mu'min, as the famous hadith says, a believer is a reflecting mirror of his or her fellow believing brother or sister. So if we were to take this particular attitude, if we were to make sure that we are tending to the needs of those who are around us, those who are in distress, those who are in hardship, those who need a helping hand, then clearly that assistance that we are going to give is going to go beyond just verbal consultation and counseling and more into the betterment of human society. And that's why on the same time we have many obligations that are also a part of our religious practice, like zakat and charity and things like that. I'm just going to go for a short break and we will be back very soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. And we were just speaking about the financial rights that we have towards each other. And we gave examples of it being zakat or charity or almsgiving or homes or anything else that falls along the lines of economical contribution, financial contribution to those who are around us, because we want to take care of people and their needs. And this is, again, the practical side of consultation. When Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, he speaks about the haqq of al-mustansih, the rights of someone who seeks your counsel in you. First of all, you need to bear in mind that you are in the position of intellectual and thought-provoking ideas, that you are able to nurture the person who is in front of you by counseling them, by teaching them the issues of skills of life and affairs that you know about, whether it be issues of halal and haram, issues of law, issues of social conduct and things like that. And at the same time, you are going to go even one step further by accommodating to the physical, material, practical needs of those who are around you. Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, he says, وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْمُسْتَنْصِحِ فَإِنَّ حَقَّهُ أَن تُؤَدِّي إِلَيْهِ النَّصِيحَ عَلَى الْحَقِّ الَّذِي تَرَى لَهُ أَنَّهُ يَحْمِلُ. And as for the right of someone who seeks your counseling, it is that you should give them your counsel as much as you think they are able to tolerate and bear. So you know that this particular person is able to hear and agree in what it is that he or she is hearing from, where according to that capacity that you have, you give them the information that they are in need of. Because when one is going to be expressing themselves in this particular way and want to guide someone else and want to give them advice, then you also need to bear in mind that this is the kind of effective consultation and counseling that is going to maybe make drastic changes in that person's life. And that's why when Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about the right of how you are going to be advising them, giving them the advice in such a way that will have an impact and effect on their lives, which is exactly why you need to take into mind what is it they are going to bear. You know, are you giving it to them gently? Are you helping them with honesty and sincerity? Are you making sure that you are also listening to what it is their concerns and what it is that they are going through? And when you do show that kindness and that sincerity, and you are gentle in the way of that you are approaching all of this, and that you wish well for that person at the same time also. And this is the way, of course, of how Prophets alayhim salam conveyed the message of our religion to those who are around them, in the way of nasiha. And of course, we're going to continue on with speaking about important points in regards to this section of Risalatul Huquq in our next segment. Until then, you are able to correspond with us on the email englishradio@irib.ir. And until then, from the studio here in IRIB English Radio, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasul wa ali nabi al-azim.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.